Monday, January the 23rd, is remarkable chiefly as a second reception for the Senate. The morning was quiet with necessary chores, a trip to dear Dr. Turchin. One's own troubles certainly come into perspective when you hear those of the next fellow. And then, a little past 11:30, I met with Mrs. Archibald Brown and Mr. Scalamandri and Bess to try to decide once and for all the draperies for the state dining room and the great hall. I am determined to have an American-made fabric, if at all possible. And as Mr. Jesse Kellum would say, I had, through Mr. West and Bess, thrown out a challenge to Mr. Scalamandri. Can you produce something whose elegance and beauty equals the looms of any other country? He brought along a piece of antique gold brocade, which he had purchased in France, he said. Georgian in design, very handsome. He could reproduce it in any shade of gold we liked. Mrs. Brown, Bess, and I all felt we were at the end of the search. We liked it. There only remained to decide which shade of yellow looked best in sunlight and gray light and night lighting. We would decide that this very night. And then we went into the great hall. The borders of the off-white drapes are so handsome. I like the drawing very much. But the treatment of the window at the head of the stairs from the ground to first floor is not grand enough, Bess and I both felt. After all, a guest coming to a state dinner gets his first impression of the great first floor of the White House from that window. Most of the guests enter from the northeast entrance, walk down the corridor, and up the stairs. And it's complicated by the fact that we simply have to hang coats and hats behind these drapes, those that belong to the few guests who come in the front entrance. When Mrs. Brown thoroughly understood the problem, she thought she could come up with a suitable sketch. Sometime during the morning, we sat down for a cup of coffee, and I liked hearing Mr. Scalamandri reminisce about his years in this country, how he built his business, how it was always the amazement of foreigners to discover how much handwork was done in his factory. His talk was very lively about former administrations and the fabrics he'd supplied for them, especially the Roosevelts. He always referred to President Roosevelt having selected this or that. I insisted on giving Mrs. Brown a tray in my room. She was catching the 2:30 plane. And then I lunched with Bess in the study while we assessed my clothes. Helen had wheeled in last year's on a rack, and we talked of what I would need to fill in the gaps, to replace those great necessities, the coat and dress ensemble that gets on the plane at 7:30 in the morning and goes all day, with constant pictures, and the dress and jacket. Everything must be bright color that takes over in summertime. Bess is invaluable in working out smoothly and easily times to see the designers I like, in helping me decide what I need. Calmness and good judgment and real friendship are her qualities in abundance, and I am very lucky. Then to Mr. Pears for a hairdo, and back for the big event of the day. Lyndon asked me to come into his room. Apparently there had been some question at the press briefing about a meeting of senators tonight, a briefing. He had not intended to announce it to the press. As well as I can summarize what he said, it inhibits the freedom of the briefing to have it known to the press, turns it from a productive exchange of information, questions and answers, into a sort of forum for debate for the malcontents, who know that the press will be waiting for them at the gates with such questions as, did you ask the president how many civilians had been bombed in Vietnam today, or whatever are the most hellish questions of the moment. So the spirit was quite taken off of the evening, which didn't at all cancel out the evening. We must get through it the best possible. I put on my bright pink Christmas crepe, and at 5:35 was in the state dining room to have a picture made with Lyndon. We're striving to get a good one together. This particular one, hopefully, would be in front of the Lincoln portrait and would be used on the program for the Lincoln's birthday reception, a sort of souvenir for all the guests. Someday, Okie is going to have all the time he wants to take a picture of us, and he's going to faint with surprise. As usual, this was hurried. Lyndon came in breathless a little before 6, and then a few minutes passed, we were receiving the guests in the green room. Tonight was the second half of the 100. We divided them pretty much on seniority, and so the new ones were with us tonight. Handsome Mark Hatfield, and young and attractive Hollings, South Carolina, and stern-faced, rather Lincoln-esque, Senator Hanson, and young, terrifically attractive, Charles Percy, whose wife looks like a girl herself, and Senator William Spong of Virginia, and Senator Griffin of Michigan, is also new to me, though he was an interim appointment after McNamara's death. Debrief, that was the first line team, Bob McNamara and Dean Rusk, and Charlie Shields and Gardner Ackley. And then to help out, there was staff, Henry Hall Wilson and Mike Manitos, who deal with them daily, Joe Califano and Doug Cater, with whom they often have contact. I'd invited Marilyn Walsh from my office because I want her to get to know something of the workings of this life so that she can write more intelligent letters. And Larry O'Brien, who has a sort of a nebulous position, foot in each camp, postmaster general, but still a pulse taker on the hill. Hubert and Muriel were everywhere. He's a happy man these days. He enjoys his job, his life, and everybody must enjoy him. There were our old friends Dick Russell and John Stennis and Harry Bird, whom I somehow regard as just an extension of his remarkable father. We find ourselves so often alienated from them by philosophy, but not, for me at least, ripped from the bonds of friendship. And the young comers, attractive Gail McGee and Lorraine, he seemed quite philosophical about his being bounced off of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and the Walter Mondales and Ed Muskie, who is becoming one of my favorites. Ted Kennedy came without his wife. Bobby came to neither reception, as usual. The line went quickly, and then Lyndon asked the men to join him in the East Room for briefing, and I took the ladies upstairs to the Queen's Room. And there our young folks were, for tonight's program was to be about youth, the quality of today's generation, a very hotly contested subject, with entirely too much inches in the newspaper going to beards and LSD and draft card burners. This was the other side of it, the opportunities, the achievements of another kind of youth. There was Jay Rockefeller, leaning over slightly from his 6'6" and beaming. I was so glad to see him. He asked me at once, with a true politician's instinct, if either Mrs. Bob Bird or Mrs. Jennings Randolph were in the group, and I pointed out quiet little Mrs. Bob Bird to him and steered him in her direction for an introduction. And this is my first time to meet Bob Taft III. He looked short and stocky by Jay's beanpole height. He was smiling, but he looked nervous. Nobody was more so than I. Linda was the moderator. When the ladies took their seats, she told them what the night's program would be like. And then she introduced Bob Taft, very aptly saying that he would be speaking in the shadow of the beautiful portrait of his great-grandmother, Mrs. William Howard Taft. He talked about his 3 years in the Peace Corps in Tanzania, and in a few moments it was apparent that he was good. He was that sort of speaker that Jim Ferguson described as get full of your subject and let her fly. He was enthusiastic. He loved his years with the Peace Corps. He made it come across as useful, exciting, full of pitfalls and frustrations, and certainly no cure-all for the world. But when he finished, I felt proud of him and of America and at ease about our evening. I had taken out the insurance ahead of time, calling on some special friends, Vidie Bartlett and Gretchen Bird and Mary Ellen Monroney and Margie McNamara to ask questions when the speakers finished. The night I needn't have. The questions erupted, and after a moment or two, we had to suggest that we wait until the second speaker was through and then ask all the questions at once of each of them. And then Jay unfolded to his full height, smiling over at Sharon and his mother-in-law who were on the sofa, and beginning humorously in reference to Bob's great-grandmother up there on the wall by saying, I had a relative who was interested in coming here to live once, too. The room loved it. From then on, he was in their hands. He described the life in Emmons, Kentucky so graphically, you could feel the coal dust under your fingernails that had been there for months, and see the rickety front porch where the perennially unemployed father of nine sat and whittled. He told the story of two boys, one who had made it. After about 3 years, Jay had been his friend, had worked on him, had tried to help him, was now on his way to college, and of another who had not made it, who never would make it, would be on the public welfare for the rest of his life. When he finished, Mary Ellen leaned over to me and said, that young man's going to be in the White House himself one day. The questions flew. Mrs. Wayne Morris began with questions that sounded like they were hostile, but was soon inundated by everybody else's questions. It was just that atmosphere of spark, of excitement, of give and take that I wanted to create. I was beaming. After the program had gone about an hour, And intentionally, before their appetite had been satisfied, I suggested that Lindbergh make sure everyone had the opportunity to meet our young speakers. Would any of the rest of the ladies like to join me in the yellow room for a drink before we went down for our buffet with the men who would be ready soon? I had alerted Libby Cater and Bess to ask the new wives if they would care to, Mrs. Percy, Mrs. Spong, Mrs. Hatfield, to see the Lincoln Room and the Treaty Room if they wished. I went in to give them some sidelights on it myself, and then continued to the yellow room with only a small stream of followers, because the magnet was in the Queen's Room with everybody clustering around our young speakers, continuing to ask questions. We had a drink in the yellow room, and about 8 received word that the gentlemen were ready to eat. We drifted down the stairs in the elevator to join them in the state dining room. As the last time, I spent most of my time walking around to visit with guests with just a bite of hors d'oeuvre instead of a plate. Senator Allott was most complimentary. He said it was the best briefing that he had ever participated in. More meat to it. Very candid, he said, and time to ask questions. There was that beaming atmosphere of a good party, and I felt happy. Vidy Bartlett had been especially articulate and interesting in her contribution upstairs about what youth had done in Alaska, principally Vista. Lorraine Cooper was not singing for her supper tonight, but I was telling everyone how wonderful she had been last week in her talk. Senator Long had brought his daughter, since his wife was out of town, and Russell Long was telling us that his daughter was going to be queen of the Mardi Gras. I was tremendously impressed with young Percy's. He is very cordial. You'd have to mark him as a comer. He had to leave early, taking Sharon and Jay with him. I'd ask Linda to make sure that Sharon and Jay and Bob met everyone. I was proud of the buffet. Sliced roast beef and chicken curry with mushrooms over rice. A lovely table and good. And I went upstairs a little past 9, and the guests did not linger. They are busy people. It is well for us all that these parties end early. And my agent told me that the guests had all gone. I slipped into my gold Madame Chang hostess gown and went downstairs to look at the materials of Mr. West in the night light. He and Bess and I walked off and looked at them up and down. A time or two during the evening I had shown to some of the senators the drape in the southwest window. It was absolutely disintegrating, full of holes, and at a laughingly told them, it was obvious that we'd pretty soon have to have an appropriation for some more. We decided on the more brilliant of the golds for the background with the pattern done in the ivory, so that there would be some contrast. And then I was upstairs having a rub by 9:30, enormously satisfied with the evening from my side of it, but gripped with tension and distress if it's being known to the press, canceled out its usefulness for Lyndon for the administration. So I read and went to bed rather early to be ready for New York in the morning.